Intro, right?
Yep, and we're live. And
Awesome.
Recording. Hello, everyone. For those just tuning in, this is our premiere soft launch of our channel on Get Vocal, which is being streamed to our Facebook fan page, our Periscope on Twitter, and our YouTube channel. At least in theory, that's what's happening right now. And looking on Facebook, yes, we are live there. So groovy. Tonight, we're going to have some fun and talk about the first two episodes of Star Trek Lower Decks. To help with that are two of our other true legal geeks, Steve Chu, down in San Diego, who is a government attorney, and in D.C., who is another government attorney. And we'll just leave it vague like that because ethics.
And Section 31.
Yeah, exactly. It's just... we're funny that way. We care about rule of law, systems of government, all that good stuff. So, Nari and Steve, this is our first time out with Get Vocal, and we're going to talk about the new Star Trek series. And Steve, you wrote up a wonderful outline. Let's have some fun and talk about Lower Decks.
Awesome. Are you guys ready to talk Star Trek?
I am always so ready to talk Star Trek.
Make it so.
So I'll just say, too, before jumping in, this is pretty exciting stuff. You know, during the 90s, a lot of people describe that as the golden age of Star Trek because you had four shows on at various times. And then we had the movies. We had original series movies, next gen movies. And then Star Trek kind of went away for a while, but it is back. And we've got multiple shows. We've got movies in the works. This is some fun stuff. And here we have, I believe this is the second Star Trek animated show after the original animated series. And we are now three episodes in. The third episode just dropped this week, but we are going to talk about the first two episodes. We are going to talk about the legal issues in the first two episodes. So let's start with the first one. Episode one is called Second Contact. And this is the pilot where we get to meet the brave crew of the USS Cerritos. And we see them from a very different perspective, not from the command crew perspective that we're used to, but in fact, through what they themselves call, you know, they call themselves sort of these scruffy underdogs. So let's start with the beginning. We've got a bunch of interesting characters here, but we meet Ensign Brad Boimler. He's giving his own little personal log, and then in bursts Ensign Beckett Mariner. They are joking around. Mariner is giving Boimler a lot of grief. She has a Batleth, which is a very familiar tool or weapon for longtime Trek fans. They start messing around with it, and Boimler is horrified, appears to be a by-the-book guy, says, wait, you gotta give that back. What are you doing with that? And she's like, oh, this is just some silly little thing. Yeah, what is this, a weapon? I don't know. And swings it around and suddenly draws blood and even cuts him. I think we even see his bone, just a really deep wound. And then they both start screaming.
You can get Josh, a certain higher level of violence when it's cartoon.
right, exactly. There are things you can do in an animated show that you could not otherwise do in live action. So, Josh, Boimler and Mariner, are they in any trouble here with this Batleth? I don't know if it's an accident or what we can say, but with this incident.
Well, Boimler's in physical trouble, and and Mariner should be in legal trouble. And, you know, I, on one level, I can identify with the by-the-book, anal-retentive character that speaks to me on a fundamental level as a Virgo. I get it. We're going to follow the rules. I like civil procedure and evidence for a reason. However, this could be a great lawyer ad with, have you been injured by a drunken shipmate with a batlet? If so, and in the games begin. So this raises interesting issues of recklessness. So we have Mariner, who is voluntarily drunk on Romulan ale, which is illegal, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And she's playing dangerous sword. And that brings us to the issue of reckless conduct, because that's not okay. And reckless means that a person is aware of and consciously conscientiously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that their action can cause injury. She's absolutely being reckless right now. She cuts him to the bone, ensure they could go to sick bay and the cat doctor could wave a little device and heal it, but it's still emotionally traumatic to get cut to the bone, not as a figure of speech, but literally. And that's a bad day. So yeah, she's going to be in trouble, even if mommy is the captain. So, you know, daddy
which
being
we found out later.
Steve, I raised the issue of the ale. Could you help us understand that?
So, you know, join Starfleet. You'll see exciting planets, meet alien species, and get cut with Batleth. Or get to drink contraband Romulan ale. You know, for, again, longtime Trek fans will recognize Romulan ale all the way back to the original series. And at fan conventions, Romulan ale is actually sold. It's typically beer that's just sort of colored blue, but it's still pretty cool. Now, there's a problem. Romulan ale is illegal, and that has been stated many times, particularly in Star Trek VI when it's served during the banquet scene with the Klingons. So is there a problem here? You know, let's talk about that for a moment. Romulan ale is contraband. It's illegal. She should not be possessing it, much less drinking it. If we draw real-world comparisons, this would be not unlike smuggling contraband alcohol across the border. Something that we see at various checkpoints is that people will smuggle various things, but one of the more common things that is smuggled at times can be alcohol, such as tequila. And that is contraband. And the penalty, typically, it's there is a criminal type of penalty, but it's a lower form. A person getting caught smuggling tequila often will be fined, have the tequila confiscated, and they will be written up, and that will sort of be it. And then, hopefully they don't do it again, at least from the government's perspective. Now, the tequila itself, I mean, it's got some inherent value, but we're not talking about huge money, so that there are reasons why smuggling a contraband alcohol is not on the same level as, say, smuggling, hard drugs or something like that. So I suspect it would be somewhat similar in the 24th century that if Ensign Mariner were caught with the Romulan ale and she's drunk, I mean, two problems for her. Number one, she's drunk while, she's there on the ship. I believe she is off duty, but she's still drunk. And then number two, she's in possession of contraband Romulan ale. Most likely she would be fined. The ale would be confiscated. It would go on her record. And I think we learn pretty quickly about her. She really doesn't care about her record. And she actually enjoys the brig. So maybe this just won't bother her at all. So anyways, those are some quick thoughts on Romulan ale, unless the two of you have anything to contribute there, or if you have any Romulan ale to share, perhaps.
No, but I do remember Quark's Bar and at Las Vegas very well, and we did enjoy that there.
Very good.
And Nari, I do not have any with me.
Have Romulan ale. I also think it would be imprudent to admit it in front of two government lawyers.
Who does that?
And so moving forward in the story, and these episodes are fairly tight. We're talking about 22 to 25 minutes. A lot of things happen. It's pretty quick paced. The writing is very sharp and obviously written by big time Star Trek fans, because we are getting, a lot of Easter eggs, name drops, references, and it's just wonderful. I'm sitting there. I think I was just laughing laughing hysterically within a few minutes, and my wife and kids are like, "Dad, what's going on here?" And I'm like, "But you see, the ale and con and all this," and anyways. So what we get now is a new ensign comes on. Ensign Devana Tendi for the science division. We believe she is Orion, and she has to be shown the ropes. So this is a good, story device. You bring a new person on and they get introduced to a lot of things, and so does the viewer. And one of the things to which Ensign Tendi is introduced is the holodeck. The holodeck made its introduction in Star Trek The Next Generation and has been the subject of many stories. And there are a lot of issues here, especially when we see how it's used in this context, which is that Ensign Mariner immediately calls for an all-nude holodeck Olympic training program.
Which is very detailed, according to
very, very specific. I quickly realized, all right, this is a little more racy than I had expected. And we've got a lot of, are there rules and regulations? Are there ethics? I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Nari, what did you think?
I had so many thoughts, Steve. So there's a couple ways to approach this. And they really dovetail together, which is there's, legal aspects that this presents or legal issues that this could present to talk about. And there's also, ethical issues in terms of, there isn't a lot of law that's always explicitly discussed in the Star Trek shows or movies, but you can kind of tell by the way stories are presented what, probably the legal or ethical norms are. And those legal and ethical norms track pretty well with how we think about these things in our actual legal system. So the two things that I want to talk about are first sort of a privacy issue, which is called more specifically the right of publicity, which is, under what circumstances can you, in this case, create a holodeck character that, for example, looks like an actual person. So I presume in the program that Mariner creates, these are fictional, created Olympic athletes, but who knows? Maybe they're real athletes. And then the second one is, are there any ethical or legal rules regarding what a person could do in a private holodeck program? And this is, maybe a little racy, but we won't, I don't need to directly discuss that kind of content, but we can discuss some of the ethics around this issue, especially because there are a wealth of Star Trek episodes that deal with this kind of interesting implication. I'll try to keep it a little short because I know we have a lot to get to with two episodes.
No, we could do a whole episode on the holodeck. I think everyone has for sure. has opinions here. So please, go ahead.
That's a future thought for another panel someday, just about holodeck. But the basic thing is that, at common law, and there's usually state statutes that create this kind of issue as well, you are forbidden from using the likeness of another person. There's other things that go with that, but for purposes of the holodeck, there are serious legal restrictions as to when you can use likenesses of others. At common law, it's quite broad, and as long as a person can show any kind of injury, you can bring a claim. With most state statutes, it's usually tied, including California's, which is I know where both Steve and Josh are currently, it's tied more closely to commercial use. So you couldn't use someone's likeness and then sell it, or you couldn't use it in a TV show or a video game without their permission, that kind of thing, and then sell it for a profit. and this is actually pretty well illustrated by what we see in the Star Trek universe. So for example, in one of the most famous episodes involving privacy and the holodeck, this is Next Generation's Lieutenant Barclay. It's discovered that he's running a simulation or a program that is a fantasy world, but with parodied versions of the actual bridge crew. and at first, I mean, obviously everyone who sees it thinks it's weird, but at first when Deanna Troi walks on and sees actual recreations of her friends, her first reaction is actually, we are invading Lieutenant Barclay's privacy. And she's obviously not happy to see herself there as well in the particular light in which she's portrayed. But there seems to be, at least no ethical or legal restriction with using a holodeck in your own private time, in your own privacy. He didn't intend to show that program to them, to do, all kinds of fantasies. In fact, she specifically says this could be therapy for him to interact with fictional versions of the bridge crew. Conversely, you have Quark in Deep Space Nine, who at one point is approached by a gentleman to create a holodeck program of, I believe it's Lieutenant Kira? Could be Colonel Kira, I can't remember. Major Kira, there we go. Major Kira.
From the Bajoran, yes. Right.
Again, for, unsavory purposes. And in that instance, it is spoken about quite clearly that this is not just wrong, it's also illegal. and in that instance, the key distinction would be that Quark was creating a likeness of Kira for sale, as opposed to just for his own private therapeutic or otherwise purposes. Now, I also want to add in just I assume people watching will appreciate other references to this kind of thing in Star Trek. There's also a lot of this in Voyager, especially with Tuvok when he's going through his Von Parr, creating a version of his wife in the holodeck because he's on the other side of the galaxy. And also when he mind melds with a sociopath, is unable to control his violent emotions, actually goes on the holodeck to murder a holographic version of Neelix in order to get that out of his system. And this dovetails in then with the last aspect that I wanted to just briefly mention, which is, of course, what are the legal or ethical rules regarding what you can do to a holodeck character? And, you know, this seems to, in Star Trek universe, this tracks pretty closely with, I think, what our legal scheme would also envision, at least, although we obviously have never encountered yet something that we would deem to be a self-aware, say, AI. In the Star Trek universe, generally speaking, as long as the holodeck character is not thought to be at least probably self-aware, they're just a computer program, and they're generally treated as such. And we actually have pretty sophisticated, you know, games and things like that where people can create fictional. I was telling Josh earlier, like, you could be in a mod of Grand Theft Auto, a house cat that runs around breathing fire and terrorizes the citizens of Los Angeles. That is a thing you can do. And we acknowledge that, like, there really isn't a legal restriction on what you do in the privacy of your home with that, because they're not. The pixelated people are not getting hurt.
You know, so that's very interesting, Nari, because what you're saying is, on the one hand, if you are using the holodeck for your own personal purposes, not commercial, you're not making money, you're not selling anything, just for your own personal enjoyment, perhaps therapy, you know, therapeutic purposes, it's more okay under the law. However, you know, there's a, you know, a gray area, and there's a line that's very easy to cross, which is when you start doing, you know, when you start moving closer to that line, maybe you're trying to make a profit, or maybe you're exploiting someone else's image, if not themselves. You know, there are issues there of ownership. You know, what ownership do we have in our own image, right? Can someone just sort of use us if they wish? You know, this has been explored so many times in Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm thinking in the beginning, Galaxy's Child, the episode where Geordi calls up the hologram of Dr. Leah Brahms to help, you know, figure out some design of the starship to get them out of a trap, and then ends up, you know, falling romantically for her, which ends up being very different from the reality when he meets the real Leah Brahms, who's cold and angry, and then finds out this has been used as some sort of fantasy. She's rightfully angry.
This, right?
Oh yeah, she's absolutely thrilled. Right, she's honored, deeply honored. Right. Wouldn't we all be, right? She feels very violated in her own privacy. So, yeah. Although at that point, they don't say that there's been a violation of law. It's more ethics rather than law, perhaps.
Exactly.
Certainly strange.
There's definitely gray area, right, where something is not actually unlawful or punishable, but could still be wrong.
Right. Maybe there ought to be a law. I don't know if you want to chime in on that at all, Josh.
I think we've covered it, and let's save it for a holodeck spectacular where we can get into these issues, because there's no shortage of wonderful copyright and privacy issues on using a holodeck. So let's.
Right. I'll drop one Easter egg, which is when you're talking about self-aware programs, we do have Dr. Moriarty, right? But we'll save that for a future episode. Yep.
And the doctor on Voyager, but yes.
Or the Dixon Hill program where the sidekick starts realizing what's going to happen to me when it turns off.
When you turn off.
But we're going to move on.
I know. It's hard. This stuff is just so great. It's, you know, we could talk about this forever. So we have some great ideas for future discussions, folks. If you want to tune in for more as well, if you're enjoying this and want to hear more. So moving on with the story now, just chronologically in terms of the episode, what we then get is an away mission, and we have Ensign Mariner and Ensign Boimler down on this planet. Boimler finds that Mariner is leaving her post and selling Starfleet technology, which, you know, typically, of course, would be a no-no. There are many problems with that, and, you know, presumably there would be some treaties and some very strong rules that would forbid a more advanced society such as the Federation from selling technology to a less advanced civilization, which is what we see here. However, as has been pointed out, all we see Mariner selling are a shovel and a hoe. And that's her defense when confronted with this violation by Boimler. So does that get her off the hook? You know, maybe it does, but I will point out one caveat, and I tried to zoom in on this. When she holds up the shovel and the hoe, it looks like there are some modifications to this shovel and hoe. Maybe they are just ordinary 20th century style shovels and hoes like we have today that we use in our backyard or gardening or whatnot. But if they are somehow technologically enhanced, you know, with sonic capabilities or vibration or something that makes them more powerful, then arguably this is more technologically advanced and she could be in more trouble. I think we are on a bit of a sliding scale here. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts there.
I do. So first contact was made. So they had figured out light speed. These are farmers on a planet that has technology that can travel the speed of light, and they need shovels. I think the Federation is not losing anything because the Prime Directive doesn't apply anymore because they're now part of the Federation. This is paperwork time. And she is, what she's doing is technically wrong because you're not following all the rules for processing paperwork so people get the tools they need. She's taken a shortcut. The American military has done that sort of thing for the last 120 years, probably, if not longer, throughout the 19th century as well, that we've helped people out. And it's like, yeah, we'll just push these supplies over here and let the refugees use them. So I don't see this as, you know, throw her in the brig, her favorite place. It's more an issue of she's skipping clerical requirements, which is a proud Star Trek tradition. However, morally right, but technically wrong.
But what if she is infringing some patents?
Right.
In replicating that shovel and hoe.
Shovel.
And as we know, in the Star Trek universe, the penalty for patent infringement is death.
Right. The creators of those items aren't getting paid or any credit for, you know, contraband sales, right? So
exactly.
Right. But the economy of the 24th century works differently. So let's call a spade a spade.
They have said that many times.
Call a spade a spade, nice.
I've yet to hear a compelling explanation for how Federation 24th century economics work, because they use credits, which is basically money. And there's gold pressed latinum. I mean, there's still, you know, there's still some form of capitalism out there.
Well, that's because there's sci-fi writing that wrote themselves into a corner and they don't know how to get out of it because we don't have that system that we can comprehend.
I could also talk a year off about this, but I think the Star Trek universe envisions a world with substantially less scarcity. But I don't think you can envision a universe short of some high concept thing in which there is literally no scarcity. For example, at minimum, there's only so many starships to be captain of.
Yes, right.
So you have to have systems of some kind to allocate for the handful of things left in the universe that people want that you can't have infinite quantities of.
Yeah, fair points. I mean, you know, they supposedly have eliminated, we as a people have supposedly eliminated poverty, disease, hunger. I mean, these are amazing things. Many of which I suppose you could eliminate through the use of a replicator.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't get rid of, you know, this is sort of the Shakespearean point. It doesn't change human nature, right? Power corrupts, and what there's still going to be things that will happen. Interesting points there. And let's talk about that kind of leads into, and Josh, your point also is very interesting, and not so much that she is trying to necessarily just help these folks or give them this technology. She's cutting through the red tape. She's railing against bureaucracy. Oh, by the time it takes us to fill out all these forms, it'll take forever. I'm just going to give it to them. Well, is that her call to make? You know, that's the problem.
No, right? That's why Kirk gets demoted from Admiral, even though he did the right thing. So at the end of Star Trek 3, you know, Star Trek 4, they still had to punish him, even though he was morally right and save the day, they still had to make an example of, you can't do that, but we're going to give you exactly what you want and let all of your buddies off the hook too, because...
But, and to add to that, just as a closing thought, and I think we can all appreciate, as all three of us being lawyers, because rules matter.
You can't have...
Even if in this particular case, he, you know, she was in the right, Mariner was in the right, or Kirk was in the right, rules actually matter.
And if the rules are making it so you can't do the right thing, change the rules. That doesn't mean you go around the system. Right. So that means you submit feedback of like, hey, people are still starving because they can't farm the land. Let's get them what they need. Let's, you know.
The growing season ends in 2 months. By the time the council meets, it'll be too late. Yep.
Yeah. Right. How do we expedite this? How is there more local control? Or like the 19th century when like ship captains were viewed as heads of state, you know, type of thing. So it's like, what can we do to expedite this so it actually works?
You know, the problem really, if you're, let's say you're defending Mariner at a court martial or whatnot, the problem really is the chain of command. Mm-hmm. And she does not respect the chain of command, and she just makes her own executive decisions. Sometimes she may be right, and okay, that's great. But what about when she makes a bad decision? Who pays for it then? And how many people are going to be affected? That's what we're, you know, that's what we're worried about. Not necessarily this decision, but it's the next one and the next one after that. And pretty soon she doesn't respect the rules and she just decides that she can do whatever she wants.
The system has to work where you can submit information, a problem, to the chain of command, in this case, the captain or whoever, first officer, whatever the metrics are, to be able to say, these people need to be able to farm. The clock is ticking. We don't have time. We need to be able to expedite this process. There has to be a system for that. So, because if there's not, the Federation and Starfleet don't look legitimate. They don't look effective. And in our, you know, governments have that in real life all the time. And let's just say responding to old Katrina, you know, like you have to look competent. And if people go hungry when there's an emergency and aid doesn't get to them, you know, you pay for that at the ballot box or a.
And again, that is the mechanism to deal with it.
So there are other ways. There are other ways to approach the problem. But let's talk about what happens at that farm.
It's interesting. You know, when we move forward, what we get now is we see Boimler learning more about the native culture, meeting the farmers. And what farm animals do they keep? These are none other than very large spider-like creatures, large arachnids, which I think, you know, in reflexively provoke a sort of horrified reaction in many folks. Not everyone, but, you know, in a good number of people. Nari, thank you for admitting, and I wasn't going to, well, now you've given me courage to admit that, yes, spiders will freak me out as well. So, you know, it is a large spider that we see being farmed or kept by these farmers, and then the spider appears to escape and is sort of giving Boimler and Mariner, our heroes, a lot of grief. But as we learn in Star Trek, and Josh has pointed this out before, a monster is not always a monster. And that's one of the great things about Star Trek. Josh and Nari, you know, what have we got here? We've got wild animals sort of rampaging around. Are there any problems here?
I'm going to go with
Josh.
Yeah. So when you have the farmers run into their cave that has a gate on it, they don't close the gate. And the giant spider comes out and chaos ensues through some weird events. Our heroes lose their uniforms in order to distract the spider. And then our poor ensign is being suckled by the spider. And
he's a pacifier now, apparently.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. He's a human Binky.
Human pacifier, yeah.
That looked truly horrible. And you can tell he's not having a good time. So it raises
When he started crying after that scene, I was like, yeah, okay, that seems
he's gonna
appropriate.
need a bath.
Yeah.
He's gonna need some quality therapy because you were in a creature's mouth and that's just not okay.
For enough time for everyone else to get yeah. lunch, it looks like.
No, no one seems bothered that he's being suckled by this spider. They're just saying, okay, Boimler, we'll see you later.
Yeah, that's you're gonna have trust issues after that. So you might think whether or not it's a wild animal or a domestic animal that is known to have vicious properties, there's strict liability under both of those situations. And in a wild animal, it's absolute liability. So that raises questions of if the spider is domesticated, okay, it's strict liability. If it's a wild animal, it's absolute. So since they do get milk from the spiders, so but that would mean it's less likely to be wild, because go milk a bear or some giant predator in the forest and tell me how that works out. You're not going to go milk a deer. It's just not going to happen. On the flip side, and Nari, that face is priceless. We do have cows and they're domestic, and there's also goat milk, which means there are goats that are domestic. So this spider seems to be more on the domestic side of the spectrum. However, it's still dangerous because it's a giant spider that likes to suck on people.
But see. Yeah. So in the standard that you have provided, Josh, it's not just if an animal is dangerous. It's if an animal is abnormally a domestic animal, such as a dog or a cat, or in this case, it seems like, you know, the spider is a very common domesticated animal. So we'll say that it fits within that category. Abnormally dangerous for its class, right? So if you have a perfectly normal, docile dog, let's say, like, I don't know, a small terrier, but because someone, you know, comes into your house and makes loud threatening noises, the terrier bites the person or something like that. Does that fit that bill? And I think the answer to that is typically no. And so in this case, you know, it is an alien planet, and the farmers do not seem at all frightened or intimidated by their giant arachnid. It is entirely possible that this is a domestic animal that is not more dangerous than its class, and it is in fact just functioning as an ordinary family dog protecting its parents who have just been shot at with a phaser.
I don't recall shots actually being fired.
He shot at the ground. Okay. He shot at their feet, but he did.
Okay,
shoot
yeah, I could see that as provocation. However, I do think it's a question of fact for the jury on how.
Yes. I just had to make the argument.
I know
that's, to make the argument.
It's an adversarial system. That's the way it's supposed to work.
We've got a good defense of the spider by Nari, and we've got some prosecution by Josh.
Yeah.
And can I just say, I have no love for spiders. This is also how the system should work.
that, again, separate topic. Another time we can talk about big spiders. But with that, Steve, let's talk about what happens with bug bites and going back to the ship and not getting checked out.
So this is a very interesting point that's jumped out at me. And this goes back to the very beginning of the episode when the away team is there for the second contact. We have Commander Ransom, who's this sort of cocky, confident first officer, and he gets bitten by some sort of bug. And then right before he's transported onto the ship, and so he's beamed up, materializes, and then, you know, he's sort of scratching his wound and becomes infected, and we get some equivalent of the zombie rage virus that just spreads like wildfire throughout the ship. It's a little bit odd, though, you know, because we don't see any specific quarantine protocols, which normally we would see, at least in, you know, our world. There's no quarantine time period. There is no medical check done. The first officer himself does not report that he has been bitten. I guess he's going to say, well, I just didn't think it was a big deal. But we've got, I mean, this is the only second contact. So the Federation, Starfleet, humans, and other officers, they have not really been in contact with this alien planet before, you know, the life on there, bugs, insects, diseases. There could be any manner of viruses, microbes, or whatnot to which we have not been exposed before. So wouldn't it have been prudent to have a science or medical team present, you know, do some decontamination protocol, quarantines? Instead, you know, what we get is sort of the worst case scenario. Someone just kind of walks into your ship with a disease, spreads it around, and it almost wipes out the entire ship. Any problems there? Nari, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I just wanted to add, so just to get into the Star Trek nerdery just a little bit. So since at least Next Generations, transporters aboard Federation starships have supposedly been capable of filtering most, you know, biological things out of a person's transport pattern when they return to a ship. However, as we see in a number of Star Trek episodes, including this one, it is not foolproof. It doesn't work for everything. And so you would think that, especially I assume this series is taking place sometime after at least Next Generations, which does experience things that can get past those safety precautions on the transporters, that there would be some system in place. Like, even if it's not just blanket, everyone who's on an away mission has to get a medical check, which maybe actually might be a good
idea.
That's
a great idea. But, right. Just like sailors before they go off on a mission, everyone gets their vaccines and, you know, medical checks and, you know, so it makes sense.
Seems like good procedure, but
it makes a lot of sense.
Even if you decide not to do that because you're so sure about your transporter, you should still maybe have some procedures such that if you get bitten by something or stung by a plant, referencing another episode here, you have to report that to your medical officer and get cleared before you can go interact with the rest of the crew. And that's exactly, this episode is exactly why they should have it.
And that's a great deep dive into older Star Trek back into Next Gen. We can dive even further back to the original series, you know, the Naked Time, the episode where Spock and, you know, they bring back this virus that kind of breaks down people's emotional and mental inhibitions and kind of makes them live out their fantasies. But in that episode, when Spock returns, he's on the transporter pad, and then he says, "Halt, you know, let's do the decontamination protocol." And then, you know, they flash some old 1960s light effects. But it looks like at least there was some quarantine procedure or some screening procedure, even if it didn't ultimately catch the virus. You know, just coming from the perspective of Starfleet, the important thing is that at least you have these procedures in place. And if they fail, you improve them or you change them. But at least you still have those protections. In this episode, we really don't see any evidence of the protections, you know, short of, as you're saying, the transporter protections themselves that may be built in. Other thoughts?
Well, the first officer is very, very concerned that, did I eat flesh? And that is completely legitimate to be upset about. And what if the other guy who got bit wants to press charges? That does raise the insanity defense because he was clearly not of sound mind. He didn't understand the wrongfulness of his actions. We could show that the virus had overtaken him with rage and he craved flesh. And he's going to need therapy after that. I've never taken a bite out of anyone. I have zero intention to. And not going to make a sandwich or barbecue.
Just wait till the rage virus gets you, Josh. When the zombies come.
Yep. Just say no. But that was something that jumped out to me about this with having, again, the crew in the first episode deal with a rage virus compared to the second episode of Next Gen, The Naked Now. So...
Right, which was a reference all the way back in the second episode of TNG. They're already, you know, pulling stories from the original
series.
There's
a reason why they call her she. So let's...
Do I have time to quickly mention whether or not anyone is going to go to jail for using a definitely unapproved biologic on the entire crew?
Absolutely. You know, we get this miracle resolution in the last couple of minutes of the show. Suddenly everyone's fine. Like, hey, we think we have a cure. Can you replicate it? Oh, sure. And then also just disperse it throughout the ship in gaseous form without human testing protocols or clinical trials.
And without consent.
Without consent, right. Maybe someone wants to stay a zombie. Who knows, right? You know?
Well, so I do not pretend to be an expert on this. However, there's a couple things to keep in mind when it comes to, you know, even Starfleet FDA, if they ever decided to try to bring down the hammer on this. The first is that there are circumstances in which you can use, or doctors might be able to use, non-approved biologics in treating a patient. One of them is when there are no approved biologics that could be used to treat the disease. Either because, like, you know, especially if there's an availability problem, in this case, no such thing exists. and, you know, I think, and this is typically only used in emergency situations, of course, you know, a shipwide emergency in which your chief security officer has just suggested you blow up the ship seems like a pretty good case for an emergency.
Their backs are up against the wall there, yeah.
The other one is that, of course, you can, a person could get an emergency use authorization, but that's a before the fact instead of after the fact, so that's not going to work here. Finally, I just want to note that there's also something called prosecutorial or also regulatory discretion. So just because there's reason to think that somebody broke the rules doesn't mean that the executive agency, Starfleet FDA, is going to look at this and think, we should really bring down the hammer on this.
Right, right. You know, it's some bold storytelling, isn't it? In the first episode, the ship almost gets blown up. The whole crew gets made into zombies. And we still get a miracle cure in the last, you know, couple minutes of the show. Some, you know, fairly high stakes, right? I mean, this is not your just regular day in the life of a Starfleet officer.
Although the reaction of Rutherford and his date seems like it might be pretty normal.
That's true. They're just used to life and death struggles all the time. And Rutherford is more upset by the fact that the engineering, you know, the fail safes didn't work the way that they should have.
Yep.
The failure analysis was, you know, is what bothered him.
It's a chance to run a level 2 diagnostic.
Yeah. You know? How could that not happen? Right. Yeah.
I see where it's coming from.
All right.
Right.
I think that brings us to the end
of
episode one.
So we are at the end of episode one. You know, I'll also just point out, I don't know if these are intentional. I assume that they are because, you know, some people believe there are no accidents. But there seem to be a couple California references. Ensign Boimler is born in Modesto in California. The ship is called the Cerritos, a city in Southern California. Commissioned in 79. I wondered if that was the date of birth of a writer or the year that a writer wrote the photographs. You know, just some rampant fan speculation.
Or
there. However,
or the Star Trek The Motion Picture came out in December 79.
Very good. Thank you, Josh. Right. We get all these wonderful, again, these references, these in jokes or just these terrific Easter eggs all throughout the episode. So it's just so much fun, you know, as a Star Trek fan. Yes. So tonight on our inaugural episode here, fans or viewers are in for a treat because it's a sort of double feature. We're going to talk about the second episode as well. Episode 2 of Star Trek The Lower Decks is called Envoys. And what we have is the Cerritos is tasked with flying to a Federation planet colony, and they have to bring a Klingon general there for some sort of diplomatic conference or diplomatic meeting. What we get, though, before all that starts, and this seems to be a pattern we're starting to see with Star Trek Lower Decks, the first 2 minutes are a very fascinating kind of roller coaster ride. You know, in the first episode, we got the Batleth injury and the Romulan ale. In this episode, what we get is a glowing Will-o'-the-Wisp type of alien, similar to the one we saw in, I think it's season one, maybe season two of Star Trek The Next Generation, the one that impregnated Deanna Troi. And it's just kind of hanging out, looking to cause trouble. And without hesitation, Mariner, who just really seems to be very experienced, grabs this alien life form, starts stuffing him into this container. And then the alien life form starts trying to negotiate, say, wait, no, don't do that. I can grant wishes. And Mariner, in the form, you know, she's just very pragmatic, I guess. She says, oh, you can. Well, how about you give me that newest tricorder? Oh, but that's going to use a lot of my energy. Well, okay, I'll just keep pushing. Okay, here you go. And now the energy ball is much smaller. And then she needs batteries. And, you know, that she knows how to get the most out of a situation. Nari, is this a problem? Is this, you know, we have a Starfleet officer almost threatening an alien life form for personal gain, right?
Good Lord. So... this is certainly not conduct becoming a Starfleet officer. I think so. There may be an argument to be made here that this is some kind of extortion. of course, I think that there's a serious problem with that, which is that it starts out as a lawful interaction, which is that an alien entity has just entered the starship. They don't just appear threatening. He is saying very threatening things. Things like, kneel before me, I shall zap you. so, you know, okay, so I'm willing to accept for the moment that she wasn't straight up just extorting an otherwise law-abiding interdimensional denizen. however, at the point at which she interrupts her arrest or detention of this offender because he has offered her gifts, you run into a problem where I think she has accepted a bribe. And that is a crime. In the state of California, bribery of an executive officer is a serious offense, including accepting a bribe, not just soliciting one or offering one. And I think we can safely assume that, you know, executive officer, which in California includes things like police officers and things like that, would probably include a Starfleet officer. I'm going to say she just went with bribery. She just accepted a bribe. And she does, in fact, let him go. And granted, he ends up not being very effectual after that. But his first act is to attempt to attack the captain.
So we're seeing Mariner is building quite the rap sheet. It's a good thing she does enjoy that brig, because she may be spending a lot of time there in the near future. So, you know, moving onwards, we get a couple of other interesting things happening in this episode. You know, the Ensign Rutherford, who we didn't talk much about in the first episode, he's cybernetically enhanced. And we see here that he is trying to please his friend, you know, to watch, I think it's a Nova or a shooting star with
Pulsar,
thank you. Ensign Tendi. And so Rutherford says, oh, well, you know, my duty shift conflicts with that. And he's enjoyed crawling through Jeffrey's tubes and doing a lot of the dirty work. And he ends up saying, well, in order to spend time with my friend, I am therefore going to completely change jobs. I suppose in some minds that would be considered rational. It seems a bit extreme in terms of the behavior. You know, couldn't he have maybe found someone to cover his shift? Perhaps, but he kind of goes all the way and he decides to switch completely and he starts moving between the different departments. He starts with engineering, which loves him, and then he switches and he moves to command, and then he moves to health and sciences, and then he moves to security. And, you know, with varying degrees of success, I think we can safely and diplomatically say. But what is interesting here is that there's an employment law type of issue, which is people moving back and forth between departments, between offices or divisions within an office. Transfers can be difficult, and people, you know, can be transferred when they don't want it, or they can request a transfer and not get it. And that can be the basis for complaints that people, employees raise. And in fact, that's almost alluded to here when Rutherford starts talking to the chief engineer saying he wants to transfer. And then the chief engineer gets a moment like, wait, are you saying you want to leave? Well, and then you're thinking, oh my God, this is going to be bad. And he said, that's great. And everyone sort of celebrates. maybe they really are more, or maybe we really are more enlightened in the 24th century. We're just encouraging people to follow their dreams. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts here?
Oh, go on.
I
thought that was pure.
No, you
trek,
first, Josh. You first.
Of people wanting to see others go to their full potential. And guys, historically, for millennia, have done stupid things to impress women. Changing jobs is not that dumb when you look at the grand scheme of things. I mean, like, if you wanted to become a race car driver or something like that, sure. But this was, you know, that proud tradition of guys trying to make life changes to spend time with a woman. Clearly, that's the theme here that we're seeing with him, because she's into diagnostics as well. And the fact that people are supportive, follow the better angels of their nature, that's what the Star Trek is supposed to be. And that there's a place for everyone. You think of the other episodes from other series, it's like, you know, both Enterprises and Original and Next Gen had historians. Okay.
Yes.
So we got a 20th century historian on board? Welcome aboard. Like, there's a place for you here. You're into art. Well, luckily, we need artists in Starfleet. So again,
if it's a sufficiently large ship, they seem to have a use for artists.
It's like they encourage people in undergrad to take electives or have minors for things that they really liked. Sure, you're going to go get the OCHEM degree, but you're also going to get something in, you know, classical art or violin. And
they have a lot of plays and talent shows.
Yes, they do. A lot of arts. Really nice.
Yeah. So I think it's consistent.
You know, it's interesting, Josh, when you say that too, that the officers are so welcoming and supportive of people sort of following their dreams and these changes. Now, I'm reminded that Gene Roddenberry, when he wrote Star Trek and he created it, and then he created what many refer to as sort of Gene's box of rules that he didn't want broken. One of them was that he didn't want conflict between Starfleet officers, that he really felt that officers should just embody the what was great about humanity and be near perfect, that they wouldn't have conflict. They would agree. They would find, compromises. And writers for Star Trek over the years have found that to be very difficult to write under those conditions. So, I think we see some differences already in Lower Decks. There certainly is some conflict between officers, namely, primarily Mariner and her mother, the captain, right? But we see a whole lot of other stuff. I mean, Mariner just doesn't stop being the instigator throughout all of this. Personnel transfers. And Nari, did you have some thoughts there?
I was just going to, I guess, for once, agree wholeheartedly with that. I think it does represent the sort of, again, idealized version of the future where even though, there's still scarcity and there's still hierarchies even, it's meritocratic and individualistic. So, the chief engineer thinks he's the greatest Starfleet employee on the ship. So why not? Of course you can go pursue other interests if that's what you want to do. I'll support you fully.
it's really heartening, isn't it? And encouraging to see that kind of support, as opposed to the reaction that we probably expected, which was, how dare you, leave me? Where's your loyalty? I taught you everything you know, and, that type of thing. We don't really get that here. So, when we move forward here in the story now, we meet another in a long line of Klingon generals, General Corrin. And interestingly, Ensign Boimler is just so psyched, so excited that he is drawn the duty of transporting General Corrin. He reads up on this, learns the Klingon greetings protocol. He gets very excited. And then when he meets Corrin in the shuttle, he tries to greet him and instead finds out that Mariner has this relationship with General Corrin. And Mariner basically jumps Corrin and they start this physical combat battle. They're slugging each other, wrestling each other. They cut each other. They draw blood. And then they laugh and hug. And it's all great. It's all good. Very interesting, because the Federation, we have this principle, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. Starfleet is so much built on respecting different cultures, different traditions, different people, different beliefs. But what about when you run into a culture that believes so strongly in violence as a way of self-expression, to the point where, greetings are physical combat and people are getting injured? As a Starfleet officer, does it behoove you then to basically engage in that physical combat out of respect to that culture? Or is there a way to kind of not do that? It seems that there has to be a line somewhere, right? What do you think, Josh?
Thinking back to the Enterprise episode Judgment, where we have a Klingon attorney discuss that there's more to the Klingon culture than the warrior caste, that there are scientists and artists and philosophers, and so that there's much more to the Klingons than the ultimate bros that want to arm wrestle and beat the snot out of each other. So there's the women do too. One section, one very big section of the Klingon people, but it's not the only section of the Klingon people. So there's a big difference, right, between accepting people who are different and relishing it, because you know Mariner and Corinne had done gray ops together, so that meant killing people. So, or spy missions of some kind. You know, they rough and tumble. But I think the overarching issue for Klingons is that they're an honor-based society. And they use the word honor like the Smurfs use Smurf. You know, honor could mean like ethics. It could mean a sense of duty to someone. It could mean a sense of loyalty, you know, fidelity to others, doing the right thing. And instead of using all those other wonderful descriptive terms to describe doing what's morally right, they just say honor, much like a Smurf would say Smurf. And just because this one Klingon is a hard drinking Klingon does not mean that that's the a cultural norm. That means that he drinks a lot. And it's one thing to come from a family that's loud and fun and boisterous and big dinners and, you know, there's wine and everyone's having a fantastic evening, to it's a slugfest and blood's drawn. So like, again, there are differences. So, and Corinne, I do think, crosses the line because he fakes being passed out in order to steal the shuttlecraft so he could go do a beer run, which is a sign that he has a serious problem. And as attorneys, you know, we do avoid, as part of our duty of competency, we need to avoid substance abuse and be able to recognize those signs. He's got some big red flags for, yeah, it's like that's not okay. There needs to be an intervention in his life. It's okay to have fun. It's not okay to be blackout drunk.
You know, maybe it's okay for him to be a warrior, but for a diplomat to be drunk and stealing, you know, shuttlecraft, it's a little odd,
so
right?
There's problems. I would not send him in to negotiate something unless it was an unconditional surrender.
Well put.
No, not that either.
Yeah, he could. Yeah. Hey, why don't we have a drink? Oh, yeah, let's just call
and
this whole thing off.
Good.
All right. You know,
peace.
Right. We're good. We're good. So, you know, that leads into sort of the next, you know, legal issue here is General Corinne, as you say, he either passes out or fakes being passed out. He steals a Federation shuttle and flies off, apparently doing a beer run, instead of doing his duty, which is showing up at this diplomatic conference. So we have now a diplomatic incident. He's stolen Federation property. Who knows what he's going to do? He could crash it and injure someone. He could do any number of things. He's could be committing crimes.
We don't know what he did.
We don't know. who knows what he was up to? Probably no good. So, you know, Nari, wouldn't he be in trouble for all this?
No. It's extremely
Nari, defending the people again. Thank you. So defend Corinne for a moment, please.
So basically, the assumption here is that when they are on this planet, he has diplomatic status as a representative of the Klingon Empire. Now, obviously, that would also require that he has been duly recognized, sent and recognized as a diplomat, but I think it's safe to assume that's true. Now, generally speaking, with the exception of, you know, certain nations or entities that you might not have a standing treaty with, for example, in real world, we have the Vienna Treaty on Diplomatic Relations, which comes from, I think, the 19th century. It's pretty old. You know, with the rare exception of states which maybe haven't signed that and you don't have that relationship with, you might still at least have a bilateral agreement with another state. Generally speaking, though, if the Federation or the United States is sending diplomats or accepting diplomats, it's probably because we share a mutual understanding, if not a treaty, about diplomatic immunity. So as with everything in international law is fuzzy, it changes. It's always being created every day with the norms and practices of the nation states as they move forward. But the Vienna Treaty covers pretty well what we still understand to this day to be diplomatic immunity. And it's pretty strong. So Article 29 of the Vienna Treaty, to which the U.S. is a signatory, as are most countries in the world, states that the person of a diplomatic agent shall be inviolable. He shall not be liable to any form of arrest or detention. And just below that in Article 31, it gets a little more specific and says a diplomatic agent shall enjoy immunity from the criminal jurisdiction of the receiving state and immunity from its civil and administrative jurisdiction. And it provides a handful of exceptions for the civil and administrative jurisdiction. None of them, though, are criminal liability or civil liability for having stolen a car or crashed it or even...
They're judgment proof. They're almost judgment proof, aren't they?
Basically. And it's a little crazy. It seems like it doesn't comport with our usual sense of justice. But there's, you know, the international law realm as like law of war and all this other stuff is just premised on very different things. So, you know, we acknowledge that we are sending citizens of another country to live in another country in which they are being the representatives. They may, you know, the host country may have dramatically different morals and norms and laws. And out of respect for each other's sovereignty, that's where this sort of diplomatic immunity comes from, is that they're each representatives of sovereign nations. And so on the one hand, you know, the host nation is obligated not to arrest the diplomat under its own domestic laws. On the other hand, if the diplomat sufficiently offends or, you know, goes and creates a lot of mayhem or whatever, there is also an obligation in the same Vienna Treaty that if a host nation so requests it, the sending nation must take back their diplomat. That's an important check on how much a diplomat can do. The last one I want to mention is that it does not say in the convention that a diplomat is immune from being charged or ticketed or anything else. The difference is that you can't seize them or detain them or confiscate property. So what could happen is, let's say that our General Corin, you know, steals the shuttle, causes some property damage on the planet. When he is then asked politely by the Federation to please leave now and go back, we are ejecting you, and he loses his diplomatic status upon returning to, oh gosh, I'm going to, for Kronos. at that point, the Federation, if assuming it has an extradition treaty, could still charge him with the crimes and ask politely, Klingon Empire, please extradite him so we can go along with our normal criminal process.
So, Nari, let's test this diplomatic immunity idea just a little bit. You know, and let's do what lawyers love in some ways, you know, a couple hypotheticals. So General Corin steals the shuttle. He's flying off. Let's say he crashes and burns. We see this large marketplace. Crashes into the marketplace. Destroys a lot of merchandise, injures a lot of people, starts a fire, just a huge, huge mess. Is he in trouble?
So yes, except there's a couple things. So the first is that assuming that everyone decides to observe diplomatic immunity, he is not in trouble in the sense that he is about to be held criminally and civilly liable for all of the damage and perhaps death and maiming that he may have just caused. However, assuming that the Klingon Empire wants to maintain positive diplomatic relations with the Federation, his diplomatic career is over.
In other words, it's up to not the Federation to punish him, even though it's their world. It's up to the Klingon Empire, his home planet, to punish him.
Yes. The treaty explicitly states that diplomats do not are not exempt from the jurisdiction of their own countries. The last thing I want to add is that with international law, there's always an element of pragmatism. So there's no court that you can go to and say, this country has breached diplomatic immunity, they've arrested my diplomat, and then the court will order the offending country to release the diplomat. That's not how international law works. We don't have a supranational body that can do that. So at the end of the day, if a person, a diplomat, commits a sufficiently horrendous offense, a host nation may decide it is worth whatever political or diplomatic ramifications will occur by breaching diplomatic immunity and just saying, yeah, we're violating the treaty, but you know what? It's worth it. We're going to arrest this guy because we just can't let him go.
So Corin caused enough trouble Man, he could be charged. He, you know, diplomatic immunity could be could fall apart there. Josh, any thoughts?
Ron was not part of the diplomatic mission, so I think he'd be in trouble. And the fact that, you know, this is an issue of like, well, this is what he does. At least the Federation officer at the end is, you know, kind of like didn't kick him, but when he grabbed her foot, you know, she, you know, shook him off. It's problematic.
And I think used like one of, I think they have like three bits of profanity every episode that was where they used one of them. This episode.
And you know what? She was right. So she was very correct. Now let's, we're, again, this is a double header, but let's
keep moving along here. Yeah, let's try to fit everything in that we want to. So moving forward, we've got some odd, you know, we're talking about the Enlightenment of the 24th century, but then we get back to Rutherford now. He's transferring around. He moves to the command track, and he is then shown to the, I assume it's a holodeck or, you know, some form of training program. Commander Ransom walks him in, you know, the bro again, saying, well, I'm glad you've chosen command. This is the place to be. And he says, there's nothing like having a joystick between your legs. Nothing compares to the firm, hot pulse of a joystick in your hands. The bridge is where the action is. Be gentle, but attentive. Get her where she needs to be. Guide her home. Those are all direct quotes from our very macho, you know, Commander Ransom. Nari, I mean, are there some? I think we'll touch on this really quickly and then move on, right?
Yeah. So to make this short, Commander Ransom is a walking, talking Title VII liability. It does not matter that Ensign Rutherford was not the target of advances or things like that, and Rutherford may have been perfectly comfortable with these comments being made if anyone is around when Ransom is saying these things, and it seems like it's just his MO and are made uncomfortable, you have a serious potential liability problem. Starfleet HR needs to sit him down really quickly and get some remedial training.
What is HR like in the 24th century? And, you know, it's odd that this is coming from the XO, second in command of the ship. I mean, this is high up the chain of command, you know? This is not some lowly...
I bet there are some great holodeck programs that help people understand how this goes.
I think you could use some MCLE, some training, definitely, right?
Yeah,
some
sensitivity bias training programs. And, yeah.
Sexual harassment?
Just discretion. Just discretion. You can think these things, but, you know, you're
right,
in workplace.
Right. So, you know, we're trying to watch the time here. Maybe we have time for just another small topic, but just some quick observations. It's interesting we get to see a Federation world here that is the equivalent of a multicultural society. We see there's a Klingon district, an Orion district, an Andorian district. Very interesting how they all sort of live together and sort of keep their own cultures. And I wonder if there are different rules that apply to the different districts as well. It's, you know, it's hard to say, but there's a lot of material there that could be flushed out. Our poor hapless Ensign Boimler, who's trying to impress everyone, just keeps getting into trouble, bumps into a Taxor, nearly gets into a fight. Nari, you had mentioned something about that earlier. You had some thoughts?
Yeah, so we definitely don't have enough time for me to talk as much as I would like to about this, but it's a great illustration of how when it comes to defining assault is context dependent. So assault is, if I can just summarize really briefly, an offensive contact or the threat of offensive contact. But what is offensive is strictly context dependent. So ordinarily, maybe shoving someone so hard that they drop their bowl of gach is in fact offensive contact and would be considered assault. But if you're in a crowded marketplace and you bump into someone as a result and they drop their food, that is probably not an assault. Same as getting bumped on a crowded train or something like that. So it all depends on context. In this case, I don't think that Boimler assaulted the Taxor, and the Taxor was definitely not justified in trying to smother him to death or whatever he was doing afterwards.
So we have a lot of great alien species we meet, but we don't have time to get into it all. This is only the first two episodes, and look how much material we have had. So I'll just sign off here, you know, with the standard Vulcan greeting, you know, which goes live long and prosper. And Spock also says, you know, peace and long life. Anything else to add? Closing comments, Josh. Kapla. I think that does it right there.
Kapla.
Mari?
Yes, that's a kapla. I will just say that I am so excited to have done this. I absolutely love Lower Decks, and I'm looking forward to all the future episodes.
Absolutely. So peace and long life, and
thank
until
you all,
next
and
time.
This is our soft launch for our Get Vocal channel. We will do these regularly. We are also helping with Force Fest. So we have two panels on Force Fest, one for Empire Strikes Back with Steve, Nari, Bethany Bingford, and moderated by Stephen Tollefield. And on Sunday, the second day or third day, we're going to do a Mandalorian panel, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that one as well. So everyone, steer for the second star on the right. And until then, we'll see you soon. Take care.